In these turbulent times, it can be easy to feel that we as citizens are powerless in the face of widespread corruption. But what if systemic change actually is possible, starting at the county level? My next guest argues just that with a true success story out of Maui County, Hawaii, where a team of dedicated activists replaced 125 years of corporate rule with home rule. Paul DeLoria is a grassroots organizer and author of Reclaim Paradise, Reset for the Common Good. The book tells the story of the Maui Pono Network, a political action committee that focuses on electing candidates who represent a people's agenda. Following a detailed organizing strategy that includes candidate vetting, endorsement, and campaigning, the group was able to win 5 of 9 seats on the Maui County Council in the 2018 general election. The response to this new home rule majority was intense. In the last 40 days leading up to the general election in 2020, offshore super PACs spent $430,000 to defeat their efforts, despite having a general election budget of just $10,000, being outspent by a 43-to-1 margin. Maui Pono Network was able to increase their progressive majority to 6 of 9 county council seats. And that's not all. 6 of the 7 charter amendments endorsed by the group were approved by voters, and both candidates they endorsed for the Hawaii State Legislature were elected. I spoke with Paul to learn more about these impressive victories and the strategies which he claims provide a template for systemic change. So the story of Maui is much like the story of America in that it was inhabited by indigenous people with their own culture, and society was organized very differently with much more sharing of resources and greater respect for the environment. Could you give an overview of what happened that changed everything?
Well, it started in the 1700s when we started to get, first of all, merchants started to come, and then eventually the whaling ships came, and they used one of our harbors here as their main base. So it was kind of this central point between the Middle East and also then the mainland of the United States. So it was, within that line, and a lot of different seamen would come by, and as a result, disease basically wiped out about 80% of the population. So that was one enormous shift that occurred. And then what happened was that the U.S. Marines and plantation owners basically got together and did an overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893. Before that, they did land distribution because the Hawaiians really didn't understand, or it wasn't in their culture, to own land. It was part of a collective. So all of a sudden, they started to, after what they call the Great Melee, they basically were able to sell land to wealthy individuals, primarily from the United States. And then we had the missionaries who came in, and their sons and daughters were part of those wealthy plantation owners that started to get more and more power. Well, that power kept on increasing, and just like for some people, when they have more, they want more power. So they did the overthrow. And there were basically, after that, 5 corporations that rule and control everything in the Hawaiian Islands. So that meant shipping, food, labor, water, all of the basic necessities were controlled by these 5 corporations. And basically what happened to the residents is that they became indentured servants. So it's very reminiscent of what actually we're facing right now at this point in time, where we have huge consolidations that have occurred. I mean, just look at media. We're down to 5 major corporations. And so with that, they're able to control. And exert that control on the population.
I want to jump ahead to around 2013, 2014, and Monsanto. What is the history of Monsanto in Maui County, and what happened with the GMO moratorium?
Monsanto has had a huge influence here. And basically, what occurred was that they were doing experimental crops and using a lot of different chemicals that they were not allowed to use on the mainland. But because of the way the Good Old Boy Network has wired things, they allowed Monsanto to do their experiments. So as a result, the residents had high respiratory problems. It was very significant. In fact, you think someone living in the middle of the Pacific would have clear lungs. No, that was not the case. With the burning of the cane fields and stuff, the respiratory issues were some of the worst in the United States. The rates of stillbirths and also cancer were rising at a fairly rapid rate, particularly when you look at the way the winds normally blow from the experimental fields of Monsanto. If you look at those lines of where the winds normally travel, that's where the highest rates of cancer and problems had been. So it seemed irrefutable in many ways that this was creating great harm to the community. So there was someone, Joe Mashala, and also there was Bruce Douglas, were two of the founders of the Shaka movement. And they were really great organizers and did a wonderful job in bringing the community together. It was the first time that basically an issue brought up by the citizens got on the ballot in Hawaii. That was the first time that happened. Not only got on the ballot, but the citizens voted to have a moratorium for Monsanto and their experiments with all these different chemicals. So that moratorium passed, and it was really a big victory for the local residents.
And Monsanto spent about $8 million trying to defeat it?
Oh, it was unbelievable. They were outspent nearly 50 times, and yet still won. Because again, you're dealing with local community. So you can get mainstream narrative and propaganda, you know, saying that, oh, it's safe, it's fine, you should have no problems. But yet the residents there who see the reality and their relatives are dying because of cancer, and they see their young family not being able to happen because of all these stillbirths. Hey, we have a problem. So you can say whatever you want, you know, with your propaganda, but we're dealing with reality here. And I think we focused on that reality. And because we did, it influenced the community narrative, which is essential in terms of really, you know, getting people to vote a particular way or do or have certain actions that they participate in. And it was really inspiring in terms of the amount of protests and rallies that occurred, people really stirring things up. So it passed. So what happened? Because at that time, we didn't have a majority of the county council who were progressive. They were corporatists who were in the county council as well as the mayor. So what they did was they basically disallowed the vote of the citizens and then brought it to federal court. Now, when that was judged in federal court, guess what? The judge was a former Monsanto employee. And that was not even looked at. Wait a minute. Isn't there a conflict of interest here? But not in the system that we have. You see, we're dealing with a system where the judicial process is controlled by big money interests. It's not whether we're protecting the citizens or supporting the citizens or dealing with toxic chemicals. No. What they decided was that Monsanto's right to profit exceeded the citizens' vote and also their health and well-being. So this is the system that we have, and people started to realize that and become outraged. And so that's when we stepped in. That's when I came back, because after that, a lot of people that I knew there here in Maui County asked, "Will you help us to organize and create then a stick?" Which we ended up doing, creating a standard pack to create it so that we can get a majority of progressives in the county council, because that's what killed that whole process. And that's what we had to do. That's the countermeasure that we have to do.
That leads exactly where I want to go next. Did the outrage from the Monsanto ruling lead directly to the creation of the Maui Pono Network?
Well, it did eventually. Yes. After the Shaka movement was, after those decisions were made, then we formed in 2018, we formed the Maui Pono Network. And again, that was based on the citizens really seeing that, wait a minute, what really drives the decision, what really makes things happen or don't happen, is the majority of the county council. Or in some counties, they call it the county board of supervisors, but it's that majority. And the majority can change from, I mean, some of them, they have three that are on that. So you got to get two people, basically. Or they have five, so you have to get three. Or in this case, we have nine county council representatives, so that means we have to get five to get a majority. And so we organized for that objective, to get at least five into the county council. We were using, at the time when we first formed, we were basing it and building on the Shaka movement, as well as something that happened in 2002 called the Ohana Coalition, because they were there also looking at possibly getting a majority in the county council. So now we fast forward to 2018, we utilized all those connections, all the different aspects of progressiveness that was developed by these groups, and integrated that in moving forward. So that was a foundation and a base that we built from. And and that's how we started the Maui Pono Network, basically.
I wanted to ask about the name. What does Pono mean? And how did you come up with the name for this?
Well, Pono in Hawaiian means righteous. What is right? What's good? What supports then the people? What supports the environment? So that is Pono. That is basically in harmony with nature and with the higher energies, higher vibrations of love and communication and support and helping each other out. That is a very broad definition, I would say, of Pono. And that's what we wanted to stand for. We wanted to stand for righteousness. We wanted to stand for what's right for the people and the environment. We wanted to stand for openness and transparency and honesty. And all of that was wrapped up in that one word, Hawaiian word, Pono.
So what happened leading up to the 2018 election? What did you decide that you needed to form a pack? And why is that important to form a pack?
Well, whenever you get into politics and you start to donate more than $1,000, you have to register in many, not all states, but in many states, you need to register with the Campaign Spending Commission. So when we, if we're going to be involved in the political realm, we wanted to make sure that we played the game by the rules. And so the rules were that if you are supporting candidates, and you can do it as a standard pack, or you can do it as a super pack. Now, super packs, that's, again, part of the problems that we face, because they're unaccountable. they can get donations from as much as they want anywhere, and they can give as much money as they want to candidates or issues. What happens when you have a standard PAC is that you're limited, but it gives you by the way, with a super PAC though, you cannot interact with the candidates that you're supporting. You're not allowed to have conversations, strategies, work with them. So part of our process was to work closely with candidates. So that means we were relegated really to using a standard PAC if we're going to be official and register, you know, with the, otherwise we would have been shut down very quickly. And so we've got to play the game by the rules, and but you can play within the rules and still play it so that you are progressive in doing things to support the people and the environment. It's a good mechanism. However, the limitations with a standard PAC is that you cannot give any more than $2,000 to each candidate that you're supporting, nor can you receive more than $2,000 from a donor. So it really makes it challenging, and it automatically makes it so that it has to be grassroots. Because if you're looking at raising $20,000, $30,000, you know, then you're looking at a lot of different donors to participate to reach that goal. So despite these limitations, in terms of being a standard PAC, it still allows us to create an umbrella approach where we're able to support then 15, 16 candidates at one time. So that $2,000 per candidate goes a long, long way, especially when it's pooled and you're utilizing posters and banners that have all your slate, all your candidates on there, but yet it's being distributed throughout the entire island. You have cards where you hand out that has that. You have information, you have stuff on your website. And most importantly, we rely on volunteers. So we do get money to do those things that we have to purchase, but it's the volunteers that make it work, because there's no money attached to volunteerism. And so, especially if it's something where they're not a professional and they don't usually get paid for doing that, then they can go in as a volunteer and they can put in as much time to support candidates as they want. So that is another important mechanism. And having a standard PAC certainly supports, I think, a lot of people to want to participate because they see the framework that you have. It's not about huge money and making money and being secretive like super PACs. You're transparent. You're out there and you have to disclose everything. I have to disclose every penny that we basically get donated, and I have to disclose every penny that we spend. And basically the way we're structured financially then is that all money's in are spent by supporting specific candidates that are on our slate and also charter amendments. And then every single penny goes towards that. We don't pay anyone in terms of salary or any type of compensation personally. We find that it's very important to keep it clean in that way. And people can feel assured that the money that they donate will go directly to the candidates or issues. And they can see that very clearly in our reports that we have then to the Campaign Spending Commission. See? So it really, you know, having a standard PAC, you've got to be transparent all the way, which we want to be. We want to do the antithesis of basically some of the collusion and backdoor deals and stuff that has been going on here in the islands for so long. And we need to put an end to this good old boy network and corporate rule. And so we're still working on it. And we have a lot of work to do in the State House. The corporate Democrats there, it's brutal. And so we keep on getting more and more state reps who are progressive. So it's moving in the right direction.
Can you talk about how the volunteers came together to form this, and you lay out in the book kind of your guidelines for a local PAC, and you talk about, you know, you have a steering committee that's kind of the overall direction of the PAC, and then action committees that focus on specific areas like media and candidate selection and networking and so forth. How did this come together in terms of the strategy in 2018?
Well, again, I think that it starts by having people who are passionate about making local change, people who want to see more home rule and are sick and tired of the shenanigans and backdoor deals of corporate rule. So you've got to get people who are passionate, I think, first of all, and want to see a change and are supportive then of your platform and agendas that you have as an organization. So that was foundational in moving forward. And part of that foundation, as I mentioned, was working with the people who were in the Shaka movement, as well as then the Ohana Coalition. So we had a base and a foundation to work from, but then we were able then to really expand that significantly. And we really did. In 2018, we basically, the way we organized is that we had eight committees that we knew we needed to address in terms of the broad scope of needs, you know, including things like a candidate committee, one who's involved with promotion and doing PR, you know, and using social media. So we had all these different categories of and basically what we did was we had a big kind of, at the time, there was no restrictions in terms of gatherings. So we had this gathering where actually the Shaka movement began. And we used that same location. And we had at our meeting, we ended up having candidates who were going to be running for the 2018 election. We ended up having 32 people show up who were going to be running for elections. It's amazing. We didn't realize that there were that many. And then we had about 140 people who showed up. And so it was very inspirational where the candidates were talking about progressive change and the needs. And you could see people really getting excited more and more. Now we had, we organized it so that we had all of our committees, we had committee heads already chosen. And basically then after we had the candidates speak, they all went to these different parts of the room where they could sign up for different committees. And out of that, we had 93 people signed up for committees. And the following week, we were off and running. And the committee heads were then moving with the different groups. And we were strategizing and looking at how to really develop them, this part of our process. So it was a good way to start. It really showed the presence. We had a lot of coverages in the newspaper and also on local radio. And with that, then we were able to get traction fairly early on in the game.
So one of the most interesting details to me was that during the last 6 weeks of the 2020 election, some $430,000 came in from offshore PACs to try and defeat your candidates. And quote from the book, you said, as soon as we got wind of it, we immediately made 3-minute videos linking it to the 1893 coup. It was shown on community TV 10 times a day on each of the three stations. So you really drew a big connection to what was at stake here.
Well, I think that when we look at a community narrative, we have to bring in the cultural elements. And the whole thing of the overthrow by big money interest hits a chord, an emotional chord, for the majority of the residents here. So we wanted to make sure that we would strike that emotional chord and put things in perspective, because in many ways, that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to have a coup. They were trying to eliminate the progressives and put in their corporate hacks. So we called a spade, basically. But we were able to do that using depictions of the actual coup that happened in 1893. And we use those pictures and images inserted in then these clips that we did. We did 3-minute clips. And again, the coverage was amazing. And it was really interesting to see that as we had people who were working on social media, all of a sudden, the phrases that we were using in that clip were showing up in all of these dialogues and all of these different pieces. So we know that the message was really getting out there and really connecting on a deep way. And so it backfired. They put in, they outspent us 43 times for the general election. And with that, we were able to still win because, again, we looked at where the emotional cords were in our culture and addressed those emotional cords. What you're doing is, again, the major issue here in any type of election process or really any type of messaging that's going out is the community narrative. And it's extremely important that you understand the culture. And that's why in the book, so much of the time of the initial part of the book was spent on how did this culture develop? What are the major elements that make Hawaii so unique, especially Maui County? And then when you start to look at the history and how things were integrated and put into, I guess you could call the collective subconscious, then you're able to address that in your narrative. And it's so much more impactful when you're able to do that. And it has a huge advantage from big money interests because mostly what they do with their control of media is look at big picture stuff that doesn't relate really or connect that much with the local community. So to capture the local narrative is so important. And again, understand culture and how to interface then your dialogue with that culture and where the consciousness of the community is extremely important.
Can you talk a little more about how you shape that narrative? What tools do you use? I mean, obviously you have social media, you're creating videos, you're creating memes. I don't know, you probably maybe have people holding up signs sometimes in traffic. You plan events in the public. How would you describe the best way to capture that narrative?
Let me give you two different approaches that we utilize. In 2018, it was more relational oriented. So we had over 250 volunteers going out and handing out cards. We handed out 88,000 candidate cards that had our slate, all the candidates that we're supporting, all the issues that we're supporting, and why. And we're able to condense that into a card that we were handing out throughout the island. So you can imagine having people talk to 88,000 people and hand out the card and have a conversation with them as they're doing it. So that's one element, I think, is having a lot of volunteers going out, having personal interactions. However, in 2020, we were lockdown time. And so what do? We can't even leave our homes. So that's when we really focused on the digital process and used the internet. So thank God for Zoom. I mean, we really did a lot utilizing that. We recorded our interviews. And obviously people locked in. They were glad to get some information that they could actually make a difference because they started to learn about the candidates. So we got a lot of views. I mean, we're not a big population here, but we were getting, you know, over 2,000 views just on Facebook Live alone. And then we had it on Akaku Television. We had it on our website where we ended up getting 128,000 views. So we're a population of 186,000. So you can see that it was having an impact digitally also. I think the ideal is to do both. To have both interpersonal volunteers that you know you're connecting on a personal level, but also having the messages through these different internet platforms. I think they're all important and certainly can add to educating the people and getting them plugged in.
I wanted to also touch on the experience you had of a candidate who was endorsed by Maui Pono Network, who got elected and then ended up flipping after the fact. And I think this is something that other people can relate to. So I would like to hear a brief version of that.
Well, you're right. I think that people who have been involved over a period of time has probably had experiences where they support a candidate, and all of a sudden, as soon as that person is empowered and has then some clout, their personality shifts. So that's what happened with one candidate that we supported for county council. I mean, that person actually went against the mayor, who was sitting mayor, who was then trying to get in to be, because his term was up and he couldn't go for reelection. So he was trying to get into the county council. And so he went against this candidate that we supported. Well, we worked hard. I coached her a lot, and we ended up getting her elected by a large margin, actually.
Can you give an example of some of the issues that were voted against? Or
yeah, okay. So yes. So in particular, one of the early on in 2018, after they got elected in 2019, there was an issue that came up where they had to approve of all of the county managers. There were several managers who were known for their corruption and for their good old boy network deals that they had. We wanted them out. So the progressives were voting them out. And then this one person, especially some of the more egregious members that we wanted, administrators that we wanted to get out, she voted to them to remain in office. And we were just like, what? What? It was like we were in shock. The people who supported her just couldn't believe it. They came up to me and says, I don't know what happened to her. I don't know where she's gone. I don't know where this has happened. You know, it was like we were dumbfounded by it all. And so I went to her and basically said that you just crushed my heart. What's happening here? I mean, I felt nauseous. I felt nauseous right at that time in the county council chambers. And so she said, I'll see you. Let's have lunch together. So I met her the following day and I said, what are you doing? What's going on? And she came with this lame excuse that made no sense whatsoever why she's supporting him. And as I was walking out, one of the other county council members who were for the Good Old Boy Network that still remained in office basically looked at me with this grin and smile and said, I got you. And I knew then that we were screwed when it came to that. However, we did have one other county council member who had we been working on for quite some time, started to vote progressive and has remained progressive ever since. In fact, he's running for mayor at this time. And you know, there's a good chance we'll support him because of the way he's been voting so consistently. So, you know, we still were able to retain the majority, but I'll tell you, that was a shock. And it was discouraging. But at the same time, when we saw what happened when we got a majority in and the changes that were happening within our county, it's like, okay, it's well worth it. And now that we know, we got to get this other person out of office. So we have some very competent people running against that person to get her out this time. And, you know, and she has a reputation of not being honest and manipulative. So be it. Here we are. But don't be discouraged. I guess that's the message. Things like that will happen. Now, as a result of that experience, we do a long process of vetting. We started this thing called the minor league, where we bring people in early on who are involved with civic engagement and other different types of programs and processes, and we see them shining and looking to say, hey, you want to run for office? And if they want to run for some type of office, we'll bring them into our minor league in the Maui Pono Network will try to get them so that they can start doing work with county council members and other key initiatives, and also to make sure that they start to testify at different county council meetings to get their name out there and to start learning about the process. Now that we've done that, we are much, much more assured of the personality and the quality and integrity of the people that we're supporting now.
I wanted to touch for a second on number of volunteers, because it seems that it doesn't take as many people as a lot of people might think. It doesn't take that many people to really make a big difference. You had over 200 volunteers for the 2018 election cycle, and then in 2020 had only like something like 40 volunteers. But even in spite of that, you won more seats in 2020. Can you talk about how that worked and why you think that worked?
Well, I would say, first of all, momentum. We have a reputation, a good reputation, and we're basically represented as someone who is honest, clear, Pono. We really live up to our name in putting out the facts and information so that we can have informed votes. So that's, you know, one piece. I think that certainly we were relationship oriented in 2018. And then when 2020 came around, we had no choice but to do things differently. In 2020, we had only 30 volunteers, but we were a lot smarter at this point in time because we had that one election under our belt. And also we had the momentum now and the name recognition within the community itself. I think that the way that we reached out to the different media with radio and local television was certainly something that really added significantly to getting the message out and words out that didn't require volunteers. We used in 2020, we used a phone canvassing. And that was an effective way to utilize volunteers, especially when you have a mechanism that does automatic dialing for you. You can cover a lot of ground. So we did things because we couldn't interact with people. What we did was we had a group that, we had about 40 volunteers who were involved with stuffing 16,000 packets, basically with all the different cards. And we had cartoon sheets, colored cartoons that we put in the packet, and then we put them on door hangers. So we had these packets with all different information about the progressive candidates and needs, and we put them on the door so that at least people will have something separate from what's getting in the mail, because they were mailing stuff at an incredible rate. When you have, you know, all of a sudden $43,000, you can buy a lot of mailings and a lot of different radio ads and TV. So they were being blasted with stuff. They were putting posters all over the place. So we had to get over that noise. And again, without having a lot of volunteers to go out and do that, we basically utilized that the most effective way that we thought of. And certainly the door hangers was a good success, especially in areas where we didn't have a history of progressive votes. Because education is key. And so that's what we did with the phone banks. It allowed us to, I think, cover a lot more ground in many ways. We still went out and we did sign wavings. We had, scheduled sign wavings that we would do, where it would be a time for volunteers, not only for the Maui Pono Network, but for the other candidates to get together and have a little celebration and fun, and hoot and holler and tell people to toot their horns and stuff. So it's a good way to get together and connect that we utilized. But the volunteers, again, I think we're going to do a combination so that we will have both them using electronic media and personal interaction as much as we possibly can.
You have also run candidates for state legislature. You had a couple win in 2020. I wanted to ask, what are your thoughts on how do you think it will work at the state level. Do you think it's possible to kind of scale up what Maui Pono Network is doing to have home rule at the state level?
Well, that is goal and objective. So we certainly started here with the county and have had significant success so far. But in order to really affect a state level, you have to have all the different counties participating so that they can get progressive state reps in there. And that is a big, big challenge. Right now, the way it's wired is that the corporate Democrats get almost some of them weekly newsletters, monthly newsletters that are given to all their constituents. So they're getting mailings and information on an ongoing basis. There's a lot that they do incumbents in terms of touting how much money they bring in to their area. So it really becomes a real challenge to work with incumbents because the Democratic Party is investing in them quite a bit so that they can stay in office. And so it's a big hurdle. And that's why I think if we can, right now we're encouraging some of the candidates who's running for state reps to press the flesh, to go out door to door and start then connecting with people, have a handout that they leave them so that there's a personal interaction that's occurring. I tell you, state reps, that's a tough one. So the way that we can do that, though, is by influencing and having a process in the other counties. So on the Big Island, for example, we've worked with a group there in starting their own standard pack. And they've done that, and they call it HUI, H-U-I, HUI. And basically is focused on is a very similar process. They are right now starting to conduct interviews. They're 45-minute interviews, which will be on local television, will be on Facebook, and you know all these different platforms, YouTube, that they can then get the message out. So they're in process. But if they're successful in getting a majority of state reps in there, and we are successful in getting a majority of state reps, we're getting closer and closer. So Oahu is going to be a real tough one because the Good Old Boy Network is very entrenched there. So, but we're starting to create, we have relationships, we're developing so that hopefully we can use a similar strategy. Again, you need on the ground people in that county who are progressive, who support progressive candidates, and are very clear as to the reasons why their platform's important for them, and that it will make a difference to the community. But again, getting that majority in there is going to be a real tough one because the corporate Democrats are really, really entrenched, and it's going to be a challenge. But the strategy that we're using is getting the other counties on board, having a standard pack like we have with the Maui Pono Network, so that they can support and encourage candidates to move forward and get those seats on a state level. So I just met with two potential state reps who are running and who have a progressive platform, which is encouraging. But that's the process. I mean, I wish there was a magical thing we could do on the state level to change things, but we have to change it on the county level first and get the right representation, then make the shift. So we're in process right now.
That was Paul DeLoria discussing his book Reclaim Paradise, Reset for the Common Good, available in paperback or as an ebook at reclaimparadise.org. My conversation with Paul continues in the next episode, where among other topics, we discuss changes to the county charter, the equivalent of a constitution at the county level. My name is Judd Staser. I thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.